I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. Stephen Hawking's Into the Universe series recently premiered on the Discovery Channel, and he has made a lot of news with his warning in that series that humans should not contact aliens because of the risks involved. So he basically recommended that we keep a low profile if we ever figure out that there are aliens until we figure out what their intents are and what their behavior is. And this is a response to that from David Brin, who's a fellow of the IEET. And he wrote a piece recently called The Other Kind of Aliens, which you can find at IEET.org. In response to a flurry of interest that's been stirred by Stephen Hawking's new Discovery Channel show, specifically his lead-in episode about extraterrestrials, wherein he recommended against calling attention to ourselves, I'll offer a hurried little riff here about Hawking and aliens, with added contributions by and about Paul Davies, Robin Hanson, and others. On his show, Professor Hawking said that aliens are almost certainly out there and that Earthlings had better beware. Instead of seeking them out, humanity should be doing all that it can to avoid any contact. His simple reasoning? All living creatures inherently use resources to the limits of their ability, inventing new aims, desires, and ambitions to suit their next level of power. If they wanted to use our solar system for some super project, our complaints would be like an ant colony protesting the laying of a parking lot. Want an irony? I'm actually a moderate on this issue, as I am regarding transparency. He wrote a book arguing for total transparency in society, which many people consider the most extreme statement on the topic, so he's saying it's ironic. He's actually a moderate on transparency as well. My top aim in these recent arguments has been pretty basic. I want more discussion. And for arrogant fools to stop blaring into space on our behalf without at least offering the rest of us the courtesy of first openly consulting top people in history, biology, anthropology, and guys like Hawking in an honest and eclectic way. Their refusal to do this constitutes just about the most concealed and indefensible behavior by scientists that I've ever seen. Now, everybody and his cousin appears to have an opinion about aliens. In fact, I know almost nobody who seems willing to wait and entertain a wide variety of hypotheses in this field of a subject matter. It seems that the very lack of data makes people more sure of their imagined scenario rather than less, and more convinced that those who disagree are dunderheads. Renowned science philosopher Paul Davies has weighed in with a new book, The Eerie Silence, which seems a bit of a takeoff of my own classic, The Great Silence paper, still the only overall review survey that has ever attempted to cover more than 100-plus hypotheses that are out there to explain our loneliness in the universe. Alas, Paul seems never to have heard of my paper or most of the hypotheses in question. He cites me only as a grouch towards METI or message to ET. And while I have long admired Paul's work and consider him to be quite amazing, I feel he got a bit lazy with this one. Paul Davies' arguments are pretty lame and possibly quite disturbing. For example, saying just because we go around wiping out our competitors doesn't mean aliens would do the same. But that doesn't mean they wouldn't either. The example of life on Earth is all we have to go on, and life on Earth is Darwinian. Davies also says, a civilization that has endured for millions of years would have overcome any aggressive tendencies. But the critic Szabo points out that that's utopian nonsense. By the same reasoning, humans should have overcome any aggressive tendencies that chimpanzees have. And Davies says, by comparison, humans would quite likely be considered dangerous warmongers posing a possible menace to our galactic neighbors in centuries to come. If so, then ET may act to eliminate the threat. So much for their peacefulness. George Mason University economist and philosopher Robin Hanson responds, many species here on Earth have endured for millions of years while retaining aggressive tendencies, and even very mildly bellicose aliens, one who would only exterminate us if they could make a plausible case that we might pose a future menace, should still be of great concern to us. I sure don't want to be exterminated just in case. Wouldn't it make more sense to shut up until we don't look so menacing, or until we are strong enough to defend ourselves? Another quotation from the critic Szabo about Davies. Davies also said, if we didn't mend our violent ways, ironically, the greatest danger from an alien encounter may be ourselves. In other words, ETI really does pose a threat after all, but it's our own fault, so we shouldn't, and we are presumably left to conclude, try to protect ourselves from this threat beyond taking a profound moral lesson from this flight of imagination and mending our own ways. This reasoning from splendidly fashionable PC attitudes combined with his own imputation of human psychology to imaginary entities leads to a rather grotesquely self-loathing conclusion. Davies puts humans on trial against aliens he has conjured up from his imagination and finds the humans guilty and deserving of genocide. Fortunately, we have much better reasons to try to be more peaceful than the conjectured attitudes of hypothetical aliens. A good start to achieving human peace would be to withdraw moral support from people who hate their fellow human beings. While I react less pungently than the critic Szabo, and in fact see a bit of merit in Paul Davies' point, it remains rather tiresome for the reflex to always be to assume that aliens will automatically be more elevated than us, yet willing to judge and crush us rather than help us get better. In fact, out of sheer ornery contrariness and a habitual wish to avoid limits on thinking, I'm tempted to wonder if humanity may be among the most pleasant sapient species in the galaxy. Just imagine a high-tech species descended from solitary stalking carnivores like tigers, or loner infanticides like bears, or pack carnivores, or paranoid herd herbivores, or mammoth harem keepers like elephant seals. We come from tribes of long-lived, relatively patient and contemplative, reciprocally grooming gregarious apes whose male-female differences are relatively small. All traits that mitigate towards some degree of otherness empathy, which may not happen very often across the stars. And still, we're violent mofos. Furthermore, suppose we concede the common search for extraterrestrial intelligence talking point that aliens would have to have learned to avoid much war given the destructive power of advanced weaponry. But is the only way to avoid Armageddon massive racial reprogramming to pacifism? A far more likely way for aliens to stop war and save themselves from self-destruction is the method implicitly commended by Jared Diamond in his book Collapse, the creation of a perfectly stable and perfectly repressive oligarchy that protects itself by maintaining a rigid status quo. And yes, that kind of stable hegemony can become internally peaceful, as in Ming China, and more briefly in many other human cultures. And yet, a perfect control-freak autarky isn't exactly utopian by our terms, or altruistic. Moreover, it remains capable of violence, especially when it sees something outside of itself that it may not like. Oh, but the most frustrating thing is this. When people leap to their own pat explanations for the great silence, sighing that, of course, the answer is this and such, and then dismissing all contrary views as foolish, out of what could be the most fascinating and wondrously open-ended argument discussion of all time. A marvelous set to that juggles every science, every bit of history and biology and astronomy, well, everything. It's the real puzzle of who we are, how we may be different, or the same as those mysterious others out there. That's what makes me sad when nearly everybody in this field leaps so quickly on almost zero evidence to say, of course the answer is, I'm above all a lover of the greatest Enlightenment invention, argument. And its accompanying virtues, curiosity, experimentation, reciprocal accountability, and even the aching joy of being forced now and then to admit, okay, you got me that time. I may have been wrong. And that was The Other Kind of Aliens by David Brin, which was published at IEET.org. IEET board member George Dvorsky has also weighed in on the SETI alien threat question, and he wrote a piece called Why Stephen Hawking and Everyone Else is Wrong About Alien Threats, which has gotten quite a few hits as well. So I'm going to read that piece to you also. Stephen Hawking is arguing that humanity may be putting itself in mortal peril by actively trying to contact aliens, an approach that is referred to as active SETI. I've got five reasons why he's wrong. Hawking has said that if aliens visit us, the outcome would be much as when Columbus landed in America, which didn't turn out well for the Native Americans. He's basically arguing that extraterrestrial intelligence, once alerted to our presence, may swoop in and indiscriminately take what they need from us and possibly destroy us in the process. David Brin paraphrased Hawking's argument by saying all living creatures inherently use resources to the limits of their ability, inventing new aims, desires, and ambitions to suit their next level of power. If they wanted to use our solar system for some great super project, our complaint would be like an ant colony protesting the laying of a parking lot. It's best to keep quiet, goes the thinking, lest we attract any undesirable alien elements. A number of others have chimed in and offered their two cents, writers like Robin Hanson, Julian Savulescu, and Paul Davies, along with Brin and many more. But what amazes me is that everyone is getting it wrong. Here's the deal, people. One, if aliens wanted to find us, they would have done so already. First, the Fermi paradox reminds us that the galaxy could have been colonized many times over by now. We're late for the show. Second, let's stop for a moment and think about the nature of a civilization that has the capacity for interstellar travel. We're talking about a civilization that has survived a technological singularity event and is in the possession of molecular assembly, nanotechnology, and radically advanced artificial intelligence, and has made the transition from biological to digital substrate. Spacefaring civilizations will not be biological, and spare me your antiquated ring-world scenarios. Now that I've painted this picture for you, and under the assumption that extraterrestrial intelligences are proactively searching for potentially dangerous or exploitable civilizations, what could possibly prevent them from finding us? Assuming this is important to them, their communications and telescopic technologies would likely be off the scale. Bracewell probes would likely pepper the galaxy, and Hubble bubble limitations aside, they could use various spectroscopic and other techniques to identify not just life-bearing planets, but civilization-bearing planets, looking for specific post-industrial chemical compounds in the atmosphere, such as elevated levels of carbon dioxide. Moreover, whether we like it or not, we have been shouting out to the cosmos for quite some time now. Ever since the first radio signal beamed its way into space, we have made our presence known to anyone caring to listen to us within a radius of about 80 light years. The cat's out of the bag. Two, if ETIs wanted to destroy us, they would have done so by now. I've already written about this, and I suggest you read my article, If Aliens Wanted To, They Could Have Destroyed Us By Now. But I'll give you one more example. Keeping the extreme age of the galaxy in mind, and knowing that every single solar system in the galaxy could have been seeded many times over by now with various types of self-replicating probes, it's not unreasonable to suggest that a civilization hell-bent on looking out for threats could have planted a dormant berserker probe in our solar system. Such a probe would be waiting to be activated by a radio signal, an indication that a potentially dangerous pre-singularity intelligence now resides in the hood. In other words, we should have been destroyed the moment our first radio signal made its way through the solar system. But because we're still here, and because we're on the verge of graduating to post-singularity status, it's highly unlikely that we'll be destroyed by an ETI. Either that, or they're waiting to see what kind of post-singularity type emerges from human civilization. They may still choose to snuff us out at the moment that we're not satisfied, that they're not satisfied with whatever they see we become. Regardless, our communication efforts, whether active or passive, will have no bearing on the outcome. Three, if aliens wanted our solar system's resources, they could have taken them by now. Again, given that we're talking about spacefaring post-singularity intelligence, it's ridiculous to suggest that we have anything of material value for a civilization of this type. The only thing I can think of is the entire planet itself, which they could convert into computronium, make it into a Jupiter brain. But even that's a stretch. We're just a speck of dust. If anything, they may want to tap into our sun's energy output. They may want to build a Dyson sphere or a Matryoshka brain or convert our gas giants into massive supercomputers. It's important to keep in mind that the only resource a post-singularity machine intelligence could possibly want is one that furthers their ability to perform mega-scale levels of computation. And it's worth noting that, once again, our efforts to make contact will have no influence on this scenario. If they want our stuff, they'll just take it. Four, human civilization has absolutely nothing to offer a post-singularity intelligence. But what if it's not our resources they want? Perhaps we have something of technological or cultural value that's appealing. Well, what could that possibly be? Think. What could a civilization that can crunch 10 to the 42nd operations per second want from us wily and resourceful humans? iPads? Yeah, iPads. That must be it. Or possibly yogurt. 5. Extrapolating biological tendencies to a post-singularity intelligence is asinine. There's another argument out there that suggests we can't know the behavior or motivational resources of ETIs, therefore we need to tread very carefully. Fair enough. But where this argument goes too far is in the suggestion that advanced civilizations act in accordance with their biological ancestry. For example, humans may actually be nice relative to other civilizations, who instead of evolving from benign apes, evolve from nasty insects or predatory lizards. I'm astounded by this argument. Developmental trends in human history have not been driven by atavistic psychological tendencies, but rather by such things as technological advancement, resource scarcity, economics, politics, and many other factors. Yes, human psychology has undeniably played a role in our transition from jungle dweller to civilizational species, traits like inquisitiveness and empathy. But those are low-level factors that ultimately take a back seat to the emergent realities of technological, demographic, economic, and political societal development. Moreover, advanced civilizations likely converge around specific survival fitness peaks that result in the homogenization of intelligence. There won't be a lot of wiggle room in the space of all possible survivable post-singularity modes. In other words, an insectoid post-singularity artificial intelligence, or singleton, will almost certainly be identical to one derived from ape lineage. Therefore, attempts to extrapolate human nature or ETI nature to the mind of its respective post-singularity descendant is equally problematic. The psychology or goal structure of an SAI will be of a profoundly different quality than that of a biological mind that evolved through the processes of natural selection. While we may wish to impose certain values and tendencies on an SAI, there's no guarantee that a mind of that capacity will retain even a semblance of its biological nature. So there you have it. Transmit messages into the cosmos, or don't. It doesn't really matter, because in all likelihood, no one's listening and no one really cares. And if I'm wrong, it still doesn't matter. ETIs will find us and treat us as they will. That was George Dvorsky, his piece on not worrying about ETIs, extraterrestrial intelligence, and learning to love the bomb kind of thing. Why Stephen Hawking and Everyone Else is Wrong About Alien Threats, which was published at the IET on May 2nd. And there's a third piece on this topic from our contributor, Philip Verdoux. His piece is called Scientific Fallibilism and SETI, and I urge you to read that one as well. And on this theme, this is Tom Smith with Destroyer of Worlds.
Whence she came, how she got here, what's her name? All they know is the trail of dead star systems in her wake. Terrible and beautiful, implacable and dutiful, to all the world she fills with dread, the lives she has to take. It's a mystery why she must wipe out the stars above. But it don't matter to me just as long as we're in love. My baby is the destroyer of worlds.
My baby is the destroyer of worlds.
She's a very special girl.
My baby is the destroyer of worlds.
The terror of the galaxy. And that's why she's the girl for me. My baby is the destroyer of worlds. Jack Kirby did her clothes design, that hot magenta chrome so fine, those big dramatic poses when she walks in through the door. from other beings she stands apart. But I was keen to win her heart. She don't like chocolate or roses, but she sure loved Rigel IV. Nothing sets her eyes aglow like leeching planets dry. And nothing means as much as knowing I'm her loving guy. My baby is the destroyer of worlds.
My baby is the destroyer of worlds.
Just watch her sensor probes unfurl.
My baby is the destroyer of worlds.
I love to see her smiling face when she devours an alien race. My baby is the destroyer of worlds. Some people think she's just a fable. She drank Galactus and Phoenix under the table. Some wonder why she keeps me around. It has to do with humans being maddening yet profound. And so we roam the universe, 'cause it's her calling and her curse. Finding worlds that teem with life and leaving cold debris. And even though she must consume whole planets to avoid her doom, I know someday she'll be my wife and she'll belong to me. To her I may be just a most, but every once in a while, as billions scream as from one throat, she'll flash our secret smile. My baby is the destroyer of worlds.
My baby is the destroyer of worlds.
And I'm so glad that she's my girl.
My baby is the destroyer of worlds.
The scourge of all reality, she'll always be the girl for me. My baby is the destroyer of worlds.
My baby is the destroyer of worlds.
My baby is the destroyer of worlds. And she's a very special girl.
My baby is the destroyer of worlds.
She reduces worlds to dross. Then we go out for Haagen-Dazs. My baby is the destroyer of worlds.
My baby is the destroyer of worlds.
Very special girl.
My baby
is the I love to see her smiling face when she devours an alien race.
Tom Smith makes his very funny music available through the PodSafe Music Network, for which we're very appreciative. So there's a new half glass full, half glass empty study from the Pew Research Center for People and the Press. It's titled Socialism Not So Negative, Capitalism Not So Positive, A Political Rhetoric Test. It's published May 4th, and you can find that at people-press.org. Read a little bit of it. Socialism is a negative for most Americans, but certainly not all Americans. Capitalism is regarded positively by a majority of the public, though it is a thin majority. There are certain segments of the public, notably young people and Democrats, where both isms are rated about equally. And while most Americans have a negative reaction to the word militia, the term is viewed more positively by Republican men than most other groups. These are among the findings of a national survey of the Pew Research Center for People and the Press that tests reactions to words and phrases frequently used in current political discourse. Overall, 29% say they have a positive reaction to the word socialism, while 59% react negatively. The public's impressions of capitalism, though, far more positive, are somewhat mixed. Slightly more than half, 52%, react positively to the word capitalism, compared with 37% who say they have a negative reaction. A large majority of Republicans, 77%, react negatively to socialism, while 62% have a positive reaction to capitalism. Democrats' impressions are more divided. In fact, about as many Democrats react positively to socialism, 44%, as to capitalism, 47%. Reaction to capitalism is lukewarm among many demographic groups. Fewer than half of young people, women, people with lower incomes, and those with less education react positively to capitalism. The survey conducted April 21 to 26 among 1,500 adults measured reactions to 9 political words and phrases. The most positive reactions were to family values and civil rights. And then they show a chart here in the study where they go from the most negative words, which were militia. Then socialism was the next most negative word, which had 29% positive, 59% negative. Then libertarian, then capitalism, then progressive. So the term progressive had 68% positives and 23% negatives. Then states' rights, civil liberties, civil rights. So civil rights had more positives than civil liberties did. So the term liberties somehow touches people's feelings that people are just being libertine, you know, as opposed to civil rights, which has a 1960s Martin Luther King kind of feel to it. So very interesting. There's an 11 point difference in the positives of civil rights and civil liberties, much more positive for civil rights. And then finally, family values having 89% positive and only 9% negative. So only 9% of Americans hate family values. Then they break out the percents who are the populations that are positive for these different terms. And no surprise that Republicans are more positive towards the terms libertarian and militia and states' rights and capitalism. And Democrats are more positive towards terms like socialism and progressive and civil liberties and civil rights. And then they go into the young people lukewarm towards capitalism. Young people are more positive about socialism and more negative about capitalism than are older Americans. Among those younger than 30, identical percentages react positively to socialism and capitalism, 43% each, while about half react negatively to each. Among older groups, majorities view socialism negatively and capitalism positively. People 65 and older have a particularly negative reaction to socialism. 73% have a negative impression of the term compared with just 17% who are positive, ironically, since they're all on Medicare and Social Security. But anyway, those 65 and older are no more likely than those ages 30 to 64 to have a positive reaction to capitalism. So older people don't love capitalism more than younger people, but they remember the Cold War and all the negative things they heard about socialism from the past. More than twice as many blacks as whites react positively to socialism, 53% positive to socialism versus 24% among whites. And yet there are no racial differences in views of capitalism. 50% of African Americans and 54% of whites have a positive reaction to capitalism. Those with a high school education or more are evenly divided over capitalism. Among those with some college experience, 49% react positively to capitalism, as do 68% of college graduates. And finally, no surprise, people with family incomes of $75,000 or more are the only income group in which a clear majority, 66%, reacts positively to the word capitalism. So class reactions to the words capitalism and socialism are alive. People who are wealthy love capitalism. People who are poor are more positive towards socialism and more suspicious of capitalism. There's also a partisan divide. So Fox News is not entirely wrong when they say that Democrats are creeping socialists. At least half of Democrats are creeping socialists. Again, to read that report, you can go to people-press.org, which is the Pew Research Center for People in the Press.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@ieet.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at ieet.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to archive.org. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.